not too much these days, but it's something to aspire to. And yeah, I think like just being intentional about screen time is probably an area for improvement for many of us.
That's something that we could probably ritualize a little bit, couldn't we? Because I think the purpose of ritual oftentimes is to firstly to remind us, but also to signal to others that this is what's happening. And if you kind of just have it like in the back of your mind kind of thing and thinking that'll do, it'll just inevitably slide away. But if you have some sort of activity which you say, you know what, here's a break, this is what we're going to do, then maybe that'll kind of do a self-training, but also communicate to others that, you know what, Will's on his sort of down he's downing tools here, you got to stop bothering him at this point. And everyone gets trained that way so they don't have to respond properly.
It's a great point, Hung. I think you and I should commit to this and set the example and see if we can get some followers. But you know, some morning meditation and evening reading time before bed, I think would do many of us some good.
Let's set a movement up. I'm in for this, man. I'm in for this. Anyway, folks, we're live, everybody. Welcome to Founders Focus, episode 27. Folks, this has been, I say it every time now, but it is the most enjoyable thing. It's my favorite thing for me to do these days because I really enjoy having these deep conversations with people who, you know, are so motivated about the challenges that they've seen in recruitment that they've gone ahead and set up a business to try and do something about it. I think this is, we can learn a lot from people that have this type of motivation, this type of vision. So I'm very pleased to be here, very pleased to be chatting with you all here as well. We should be multi-streaming this, so we're on Crowdcast, LinkedIn Live, Facebook Live, Twitter, everywhere. So if you're around those places, welcome to the show. And of course, today I am speaking with Will Laufer, CEO of Prelude. So Will, great to see you on the show, man.
It's amazing to be here, longtime follower and fan of everything you do, Hung. So big honor to be on the show.
Believe you me, the honor is all mine, man. Especially as I'm very conscious of the kind of capacity issues CEOs have of these young technology businesses. So what like important thing did you have to sacrifice in order to be on the show today? With like, I'm conscious I'm costing Prelude money here. So what did you have to cancel to come onto the show, man?
To be honest, I think your audience is an amazing one that I always look for opportunities to connect with. So don't sweat the dollars and cents piece. You know, what else do I have going on? Honestly, the team is growing. I spend a lot of my time, ironically enough, thinking about hiring and sort of team growth and yeah, just kind of managing and building a really amazing team. So if I'm not on with you or doing something external facing, I may be on with customers, but these days more often I'm on with candidates and thinking about how to grow the team.
Okay, quick one then. We might as well plug some roles here. What are you hiring for, Will?
Across the board, we're hiring on the technical side, full stack, infra engineers, and on the growth side, we're hiring in sales, support, implementation, really kind of a bunch of different customer facing roles. So if you're excited about getting in early stage at a company that's trying to, you know, rethink the way hiring can and should be done, we would absolutely love to speak with you.
Grace, would you take ex-recruiters for some of the sales roles, or is that a good background or not?
I'm open to it. There are certainly, my background's in sales. If someone's excited about kind of a closing sales type of role, I would love to speak with them. And if they have the right motivations, I'm sure we can make something work.
Get on it, folks. It's will@prelude.co, I believe it is.
That is right. Yep.
So get on it. Get in touch. Okay, let's start with the team building, Will. Especially as you're growing the team right now, a lot of people say, you know what, your hires from 0 to 50 are the ones that are the most important ones because these people will have a disproportionate impact, like in disproportionate 2-3 year, 5-year impact on the rest of the business, especially as they grow into hiring managers. What are you putting into place to make sure that these are the people that are going to be a good fit for how you operate and a good fit for what you think the business needs to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. Something, again, honestly, I think about pretty frequently. And, I am lucky to come from having worked at another startup that grew really quickly. And we had to, you know, sort of figure out many processes about building an early team and scale a company from about a dozen folks when I joined to over 200 by the time I left. So there was a lot I learned from my mentors and managers there. Also, a lot of mistakes I made that I was able to learn from. So trying to apply as much of that as possible to what we're doing today. I think, you know, there are a lot of things we do, but maybe the first ones that come to mind is, first and foremost, I think the earlier you can think about running a structured hiring process, the better, because it is so easy to sort of default to like, hey, I have a good feeling about this person, or we share a great mutual connection and we want to move fast at this early stage. But in my opinion, it's pretty inevitable that the sooner you actually add structure and you force yourself to think critically and in an unbiased way about what you're looking for and what skills you think will make someone successful, it'll just pay dividends for every single hire you make from there on out. So for us, that really came in the very earliest days when it was me and my co-founder just thinking about sort of how do we want to hire and how can we be really intentional. To your point, Hung, these first few hires are our business. They are our company. And, you know, they will determine who the next few hires, the next few from there will be. So we have to be thoughtful and we have to be structured about our approach there. I think on top of that, like another rule of thumb that I learned in sort of a previous role that I'll share is just, if you're unsure at this stage, it's a no. I think being slower, but being selective is extremely sort of net positive for the business, even though it hurts not to have that support person or salesperson come in and take something off of my plate in the very earliest days. It hurts more to have that be the wrong fit. It hurts to the business. It also hurts to that person. And I think really, again, being sort of thoughtful, and even though it can be very challenging, being slow to move fast in the future is actually some words of wisdom that were imparted on me that I found very valuable at this stage.
Wow, two really good points there, Will. Let's talk about these a little bit in turn. So I love the idea of getting, like, there's no early time to have a philosophy on recruiting. Because it's almost like laying down bad code onto a system. If the early stuff is really bad, you're building it on basically a house of sand. At some point, it will collapse. And that the later you leave it, the worse, the more painful that collapse is going to be. So imagine if you had a CEO that was a little bit shoot from the hip and got you to 50 and then started to put structure in. Everyone then has to rework their own ways of working. And that is a painful process. So I love the fact that you've put that into play. And we need to talk about sort of how are you using the product to support you here? Or is there some sort of feedback loop that's helping you understand how to do it better? Because I guess the purpose of Prelude is, in many respects, recruitment optimization, process efficiency, and stuff like this. So how are those two things feeding into each other? The growth plus the idea of actually using the product to, almost as a product development process as you're hiring.
Yeah, it gets pretty meta. We definitely are big proponents of dogfooding our own product. And I think it's an invaluable way to sort of get the most direct feedback you can is when you're the user, right? And if we can use our own product and sort of see where it helps and where it breaks, we'll identify things and be able to fix them before our customers do, which is so crucial and valuable. In terms of feedback loop, it's a really, I personally find that to be a really hard question because at our size, even at 10 times our size, it's hard to sort of have statistically significant data. It's hard to say, okay, we might have made a great decision here or a poor decision there, but what can we extrapolate about our process that will help us repeat this 10 times or 100 times or whatever it is? Look, if you're Google, you can take the hiring data across tens of thousands of hires a year and say, okay, where are we, you know, based on performance reviews and retention, where are we doing a good job and where aren't we? At our size, it really comes down to managers, and we have to trust our managers and sort of say, okay, like when we make a mistake, when we have, sort of decided to move forward with someone that wasn't a fit, let's do a postmortem. Let's figure out why. Let's own that and sort of use it as a learning opportunity. Let's not sort of at this stage, right? Like we shouldn't be embarrassed of our mistakes, but there are chances to kind of improve the system and just every kind of day, hopefully make compounding improvements that we can build on top of. So I wish I had some answer for you that we've got some secret algorithm or formula that sort of tabulates exactly what we can be doing better every time we make a hire. But the reality is it's through conversation, trusting managers and just trying to be introspective.
Let's look at it a different way, Will. Has there been something in your own recruiting efforts that has caused you to change the product? Mm. So as you're recruiting, you thought, you know what, we're using this, but this is a bigger problem. We need to do this. Has that a sort of event emerged in your journey?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the short answer is yes. And the kind of, I'll try to sort of share succinctly without getting too much in the product details right now. I'm happy to, but I think the key idea is by sort of forcing ourselves to use the product and be in the shoes of our customers, I think we were able to sort of build more empathy for what I see as a big driver for our product and demand, which is the experience of the candidates. That really is why I think many teams rely on Prelude and sort of champion Prelude today, is that we've taken maybe an initial problem that we focused on around efficiency and kind of automation, and in listening to customers and using the product ourselves, come to the realization that while that's an important problem, it's actually not at the core of why people are so excited about our product. What's at the core of that is just kind of, sort of standing out to candidates in ways that aren't possible today, breaking through the noise and delivering an experience to candidates that is just better than the experience that those same candidates might be getting at other companies that they're talking to at the same time. Time and again, we hear heads of recruiting, or again, ourselves kind of thinking about, wow, if we could add this feature that could just make the experience feel more personal or just a little more modern or branded for candidates, that would just be amazing. And that has led to, I think, a lot of the innovation and additions we've made to the product over the past, 6 or 12 months. And I think with some exciting things to come in the next 6, 12 months and beyond.
Yeah, I'll definitely ask you about that because it's an exciting moment in a kind of a company's journey where you're at right now, where you have a product, it is out there, there's companies using it, you're learning, you're growing, all of those things. This is probably as cool a time as it is to work in kind of this type of business. So fantastic stuff. Let's talk about the second sort of thing you introduced, Will, which is the idea that, if you're not sure, you got to say no. A critic might say, all right, Will, aren't you just like doing a gut feel thing here? And isn't gut feel a bad thing? So how would you address that critique of your current position on making that final decision?
Yeah, that's a really fair question. To some extent, gut feel will always sort of play a role. And I think it's our jobs as hiring managers and recruiters to try to fight that, right? To try to add structure and frameworks and rubrics to remove bias from the process and remove gut feel from the process. On the flip side, even if you have a very, very structured process, it is very rarely, if ever, a binary. When I think about a typical recruiting process that we put a candidate through today, there are probably 3 or 4, sometimes even 5 rounds of interviews. Some of them are simple screens or take-homes. Other ones are more kind of intense, where a candidate might meet with a few different people from the team over a variety of meetings, each with kind of different sort of focus areas or behavioral sort of elements that we might be interviewing for. And then we have to get together and debrief, and we have to compare notes, and we have to hash it out, and we have to say, well, how strongly is your excitement in this area? And how do we compare that to what might be a little bit of a sort of yellow flag in this area? And when you start to get, rubber hits the road there, I think you can form an opinion of whether, as a team, we are really excited and we think there's some spiky things that we want to invest in with this person. Or if, could this person do the job? Maybe. We have some concerns culturally. We have some other areas that they didn't perform well. And when I start to hear that tone come over the debrief and the team start to talk in that kind of hedging a little bit attitude, to me, that's where I think the learning has been, let's just call it no, let's move on, and let's find someone that we as a team feel really kind of, sort of excited about.
Yeah, I totally get it. I remember working for a couple of companies, and I kind of adhere to that view, especially at early stage, because again, the disproportionate impact a bad fit might have for a team of 10, a team of 50 is significantly bigger than if you're a 10,000 person organization where, there's another place where that person can go if that's a problem. If you're literally locked in, it's difficult. Are you prepared to bang the table for this guy or this girl? Or if not, then, let's deal with the sunk cost. Cause I think that's the challenge, isn't it? Cause you might've invested time, you might've processed a lot, you might've, the job might be open for longer than you'd wish. And you think, I just want to get rid of it, but no, you got to be strong there. So, very, very interesting indeed. When is the next stage where recruitment changes for your business, Will? Is there a number of headcount where you're looking at it and thinking, we've scaled it to this point, but here is the moment where I've got to step away, or here is the moment where other things need to happen. Is there some vision in your mind as to when you're going to hit that sort of capacity point?
Yeah, we just hit one of those points, which was a few months ago, we brought on board a head of recruiting. And until that point, that was a hat that I was wearing along with my co-founder. That has been, you know, sort of marked a big shift. It is one that I'm really excited about. I think being able to have a thought partner in this process, and while it is a problem space and a process I think a lot about, honestly, bringing in someone who knows more than I do and has a lot more experience kind of building and scaling teams has been amazing. So that was a really big milestone. You asked about, is there a point where I step back? Probably, but I want to delay that point as long as possible. And I don't know when that comes just yet. For now, I think I'm still involved in interviewing every candidate and you know that we speak with. And I hope to kind of keep that as one of the last Legos that I hand off, to use a you know, sort of business analogy, because it just is the most important thing still. And hopefully I can sort of help be that voice of, look, let's make sure we're excited. Let's keep the bar really high and continue to focus on the right things. So we did just hit that big milestone. I'm not sure when the next one comes, but hopefully not too soon.
How is your ego going to handle it when this person is like deconstructing your recruitment process? Will?
I know. I think being a founder in many ways is an exercise in constantly having to check your ego, which hopefully I'm getting better at over time, but I'll let my team be the judge of that. It's a good point. I think there are a lot of aspects of our process that I, you know, my co-founder and I both painstakingly spent a lot of time kind of designing, thinking about, and developing. And it's hard to kind of come in and say, well, maybe this isn't right, and maybe there are other ways of doing things. But ultimately, you have to trust your leadership. You have to trust your team and managers. And in this case, at least, I really do. So I think. Long term, it feels like changes for the better as we sort of mature a little bit as an organization.
Fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about sort of like rewind time way back, Will. Was the entrepreneurial path always something that was going to be on your horizon, or did this kind of just emerge as a result of you interacting with the right sorts of people or the right sorts of companies? Like, did you know, when was the moment when you knew you're going to set up your own thing and go for it?
Yeah. It was not always on my horizon. If you'd asked me when I was in college or after college, is founding a company, something you're going to do, I'd say maybe I wouldn't rule it out, but it was certainly not ever part of any kind of master plan. I probably credit a few lucky jumps in my career to kind of where I am now. The most important one maybe is that before I started Prelude, I actually worked mostly in and around education. That was kind of the space that where my background was, and I actually was really felt really connected to it. And to make a long story short, I had been living and working on the East Coast and didn't have much idea or didn't have any plans to change that until I heard about a small company called Clever that was working on some problems in education technology that happened to connect to some of the other things I was thinking about and working on. And I thought it was really interesting. So I reached out, ended up meeting the founding team there, and came away so deeply impressed with the people more than anything else that I just had this kind of this seed planted that I wanted to work with that group of people. And in my life, I think sort of trusting my gut on people more than anything else has really kind of led me to some of the best experiences and opportunities. And this was one of those times where it didn't really make that much sense financially or for a bunch of other reasons, but just from a kind of connection and people perspective, it felt right. And ended up joining that company, which was an early stage startup in the Bay Area, and the company grew, my responsibilities there and some of my kind of ideas about problem solving and business building grew. And ultimately my experience there becoming a manager and having to think about hiring and seeing firsthand how hard that was and in some ways broken that process felt is what ended up inspiring Prelude. So really was kind of a lucky set of, I think, dots that were connected, but just surrounded by some really great people that excited me about this potential to take an idea, turn it into a business, and sort of see the impact on the real world.
That's fantastic. That a couple of things we want to talk about there. Number one, I'm pro gut feel, by the way. A lot of people criticize me for this. but gut feel is a kind of big data, isn't it? I mean, basically, you are kind of like getting the information from all of the history of you being a human being. You've imbibed all kinds of data osmotically without even thinking about it, and it's gone into how you think and make judgments. So I don't think we can dismiss that, right, even though the current fashion is to say gut feel is bad.
Not to turn everything into tech, but we've spent a lifetime sort of training a model, right, on gut feel. It's sort of, we don't know what the algorithm says exactly, but we've just had years and years of taking data in and sort of seeing results. And so there are definitely times and areas where it can be challenging or even problematic, but oftentimes it's kind of the most fundamental and sort of strongest signal out there.
I think maybe where we can handle the ethical issue here is where, if it is like you're the person that's most at risk, so you're the person that is the subject of your gut feel decision, then I think that's probably where, yes, you're kind of ethically clear to go. Like in your situation, if you messed up, man, you were going to mess up. That was it. Yeah. So I think that's where I think gut feel definitely should sit and be very comfortable with it. Where it becomes difficult is where you're subjecting it onto other people or projecting it onto the people coming through, then that's no bueno, because the other person is going to have the greater impact. But you say, we've been training ourselves. We shouldn't deny it. We see a lot of people kind of, I think, erroneously critique the concept, but the reality of it is it does still drive a huge amount of our decision anyway, yeah, even though we may, you know, a posteriori, so to speak, you know, rationalize our thinking and thinking, yes, I made an ROI on this. No, you didn't. Yeah. You know, you made a good call, and then you're trying to make yourself feel better for it. What was interesting here is that probably this entrepreneurial journey wouldn't have happened in the way it did without you kind of surrounding yourself with these people that have that energy and have that kind, yep, of milieu. Can you give us a little bit of a feeling as to what that was? I mean, what culturally did you see within that business early on that made you so inspired so as to even relocate yourself across the country to do that? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. It's fun to reflect. I haven't sort of thought about, really unpack that in a long time. Look, on the one hand, I was coming from a more button-up working environment in New York and went to an office that actually felt like Silicon Valley. This was before the show came out and, you know, sort of, or I mean the HBO show Silicon Valley, right? It actually felt like there was a keg in the corner and all this kind of stuff, which, you know, in hindsight, probably was not... I don't know. There are a lot of ways that I think Prelude has taken some, applied some learnings in both directions from that. But at the time I was in my mid-20s and just sort of like, this can be what work is like. I shouldn't even say the keg in the corner. That wasn't the exciting part, but there were
I'm also pro keg. I'm pro, yeah.
pro keg. I'll say at least at that time I definitely was, but you know, there were people were playing all sorts of kind of like, I don't know, just like games and they had great food and it just felt like a much more kind of welcoming and warm environment. And maybe there was less, at least for me personally, less cynicism about this stereotype of Silicon Valley at the time. I thought, wow, this is really different and interesting and sort of welcoming. And then I sort of got to know the team through a day of interviewing and just was sort of taken aback with, coming from, again, an environment that felt more buttoned up, taken aback with how there almost felt like there was no status quo. Or if there was, like, it was so so natural to, like, question everything and challenge everything, whether it was me in the interview process or just, like, being excited about any question or challenge I presented to them, as opposed to sort of stepping back or feeling that I was overstepping or anything like that. It was this kind of very deep... openness, curiosity, and not being afraid of sort of like really seeking out what was right and what was true about kind of problems that I found really exciting and invigorating and very different from anything I had experienced before. And I just thought that kind of approach to problem solving and yeah, I guess more generally sort of building teams and companies was so novel that I thought, hey, this is exciting to me. This feels right or more right than kind of the sort of hierarchical structure that I found myself in at the time.
You know what? Companies have struggled to preserve this sense You know, mm-hmm. I totally resonate with what you're saying. And I think anybody who's listening here that's worked for a company of a similar stage, that's trying to challenge and trying to do new things, that is definitely the vibe. It is. Let's get rid of the bureaucracy. Everyone is looking forward. The optimism is high. The energy levels are through the roof. It's amazing to place the work. But how does that company suddenly become the bureaucratic, ossified thing, which it kind of ends up becoming, right? I mean, maybe there's a purpose for bureaucracy. I think there is. There probably is a compliance reason, definitely efficiency reasons and stuff you need to do at scale. But it's one of the big challenges. How do you preserve that sense and so that people are not completely crushed by it? Is that something you've thought about building Prelude, or is it too early to contemplate? Because obviously you're too young at this stage. You're probably still at the same stage where it is still forward-looking and whatnot. But are you conscious of the fact that, look, we've got to watch out for bureaucratic creep, let's say, or hierarchical creep happening at some point in our business?
Yeah, I'm conscious of it. I don't have, I'd love to give you a soundbite on how to beat it. I don't have all the answers. One area that I've been meditating a lot on is, as we've grown and now for the first time have sort of managers at the company, and there is sort of more of organizational structure, I think a lot about communication, how sort of easy communication felt when the team was 5 or 10 or sort of 15 people. And even in kind of doubling from there, noticing how much harder it gets, and just the uncertainty of who has what context and how best to kind of spread that context, sort of the different weight that people's words carry. Even myself, it's sometimes easy to sort of forget. You know, I like to think that I have a very informal relationship with many people on the team, but I have to also think about sort of some of the structure and sort of being thoughtful about how things are communicated in ways that I probably didn't even just a year ago. So communication is one area that I'm really interested in sort of thinking about how we can avoid, you know, sort of avoid the big mistakes as we grow to 50 and 100 and sort of beyond. And but I'm not sure where the answers lie. And if you have any great resources, I'd love to read them, because it's a really interesting, question.
If I had the answers, man, I'd be a rich fellow. Because I think it may just be inherent, I wonder, in terms of, like, as human beings, like, increase the scale of their unit of organization. I just wonder whether you might just need that bureaucratic infrastructure for things to happen. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it just becomes chaotic, or just stays in like little groups of kind of these little units. Then it never gets to scale.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't to cut you off. My hypothesis on a bit of the bureaucracy is that it's needed for predictability. I think as companies get bigger, they sort of value predictability and forecasting, sort of more than just the sort of like explosive kind of jumps forward in innovation and progress and things like that. And to be predictable, there can't be, sort of some lone person doing this crazy project and you don't know what to kind of forecast out of it, right? You need structure and operationalizing every process, and sort of even at the expense of maybe some efficiency and some creativity and things like that. That's where I see companies tend to make that trade-off. And again, maybe it's the right thing for many companies to be able to tell their investors or whatever it is, hey, this is what we're going to close next quarter. But it certainly feels like it has some pretty big cost too.
That you've just described, I just realized that companies are just macrocosms of individual human lives, right? Because as you get older, you've just got more vested interests and more things relying on you. Of course, you need to be more predictable. You know, if you're a business with 10,000 employees, you've got them all on payroll. Of course, you need to be more predictable, because you have all of those responsibilities, all of those stakeholders. If you're smaller, you're agile, plus everyone is like pretty much in that same kind of mental state as well, then of course you can take more risks. You're almost like a teenager at that point, exploring and pushing against the barriers of the possible. But once you're like middle age, or you're at the point where you've achieved your thing, then it's about preserving your thing, or incrementally expanding your thing at less effort. So maybe that's a universal rule, man. I don't know. Very interesting. Very, cool. Very interesting. biggest mistakes you've made being a CEO of Prelude? I don't want to dwell on this too much, but I wonder whether you can think back in the time you've spent steering this ship and you look back and you think, you know what, if I could take this one decision back, I would definitely redo this one. Do you remember what that would be?
That's really interesting. To be honest, not on the tip of my tongue. We make so many mistakes every day, but I think we try to build a culture that is in some ways celebrating mistakes. And it's a fine line to walk, but I think in a high trust environment, our mistakes, again, are opportunities to just make the system more resilient and sort of better. Let me think. Yeah, I do have an example. This is a bit in the weeds, though. It's maybe not quite at the strategic level. If I think of something better, I'll share it too. I'm happy to be transparent. But one thing that I pushed on very, very hard in the early days was a move up market. We had clearly sort of, it was maybe the team size was less than five. It was my co-founder and I and a couple of other employees. We had clearly found some early traction. We had a customer base that was growing and was excited about our product. But most of them fell into the category of relatively small startups at the time, maybe under 250 employees and a set of criteria that made them easier to sell to, easier to work with, just kind of, sort of better fits for us. And pretty quickly, we started to get some interest from larger companies because we were tapping into real problems that were being felt by companies across the spectrum. And I pushed very hard for us to figure out how to serve and support those companies when, in retrospect, and arguably, I had enough information to understand this, and I actually had people on my team, including my co-founder, pushing back on me at the time. We were not ready at the time. And I would say in retrospect, it cost us probably on the order of 6 months of progress, which, sort of what did it look like specifically? We took on pilots with some really large companies. We built really specific things that they, sort of had demanded for us to kind of move forward. Ultimately, kind of, sort of one of the more prominent ones, we didn't even close as a sort of like follow-on customer. And it cost us a lot of time and momentum. It was pretty deflating when that happened, which was just kind of hard when you're in that early stage and you need every ounce of kind of momentum that you can get to work through hard problems. And it was a mistake that, was informed by honestly some closed-mindedness where I just thought, hey, bigger logos, bigger dollar signs, bigger, bigger impact too, right? More users. And there were things that were aligned with my values, but I didn't sort of take a hard, I got too excited about the kind of potential outcome and didn't take a hard look at sort of, what is the right long-term thing to do for the business? And I regret it.
That's thank you for sharing that. That's a painful experience. I've been through that myself. We do get kind of eyes kind of get persuaded by the big brands and the logos and so forth. They mm-hmm. are worth pursuing, of course, but you've got to analyze what the implementation cost is, because that customer mm-hmm. is an expensive customer to acquire, right? I totally get it. The high demand, high maintenance, lots of different interactions. You're not going to close on three calls, It's like there's a like, significant acquisition totally. Cost there. So I totally get it. What's the best decision you've made since you launched Prelude? Is the one where you look back on, you think, you know what, I nailed that tough call? I'm not talking about the easy ones. I'm talking about one where it could have gone one way or the other, but boom, you went with it. It was a 50-50 and it came through.
One fun one, I wouldn't call this necessarily our best decision, but we started before the pandemic as a company. And when it was just me, my co-founder and I, we faced at the time, what felt like a really hard call, which was, are we going to build this company in San Francisco where we both lived, or are we going to build it remotely? And I know it sounds kind of silly these days, but at that time, that was actually like, even the idea of building or committing to a remote business, especially coming from both of us had worked together at a company that was co-located and, sort of had a great office culture and so on and so forth. It felt like a very contrarian decision, but we sort of like tried to reason from first principles and think about what the hardest challenges of the early stages of this business would be. And we were both very, very high conviction that the biggest challenge would be attracting great talent. even though you and I love this space, I think sometimes it's hard to get, it can be hard to get the best folks out there to get excited about some of the problems that we work on day in, day out. And so we thought about how can we stand out and really find ways to work with the very best, the very best people. And decided to commit to building a team fully remotely from day one. Again, it turns out now we're a little ahead of the curve and it's no longer much of a differentiator, but it actually did set us up to start thinking about sort of what does remote culture mean very early on, which I think has paid dividends given how the world has evolved and has led to our ability, I think, to cultivate a really, really amazing team that I'm tremendously proud of. So that was just a maybe quirky, unusual one that we took a bit of a stance on early on.
I don't think quirky at all, Will. I think that's super important. And as you say, we forget 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, it was a niche play to be a remote only business. It was, there were a few out there, but they were almost at the edges of, they were on the margins and they were like the kind of, the hermit on the hill kind of folks who are just yelling into the civilization. And we're thinking, what the hell are they doing? It was not many people doing it and far less were people voluntarily doing it. So the fact that you did it kind of during or just at the early stages of pandemic, obviously the wisdom I think has come through. The companies that are making switches now, I think that's where the challenge is. The switching costs very painful, switching oscillating backwards and forwards even more painful. So I think we're all working through that right now. Remote CEOing then, what does that involve? How is that different in your conception to leadership in an in-person environment? I mean, do you spot any differences in terms of your actions, behaviors, distribution of time?
Interesting question. Yes, maybe I'll go back to a point we talked about before, which is that I think a core part of my job is revolves around communication, keeping teams on the same page, making sure everybody has the context they need to make really great decisions. And I do think that's fundamentally different in a remote environment than in an office. Sort of when I managed a sales team in my last job in an office, it does feel very different to be able to grab someone, pull them into a conference room, have a one-on-one chat with them just like that, to be able to hop in and just silently sit in the corner and listen into a call and discuss it in person afterwards, to be able to give really, sort of sometimes tough feedback or whatever is needed in the moment. Of course, there are approximations of that in a remote environment, but they are just that. They're proxies. It's not the same as being able to, be in a soundproof room and have a heart-to-heart saying, hey, sort of this is coming from a place of care, but that wasn't great. And we need to talk about how to sort of fix it. So all that's to say, I do think there are some differences that can be hard to articulate. I think trying to be thoughtful about how we build those channels of communication and build those channels of trust in a remote environment, there's no one-to-one replacement. So being creative about how we do that, thinking about, for us at least, balancing, sort of remote day-to-day with trying to get everyone together at least a couple times a year in person so we can still sort of build some trust and culture and things like that. We were recently as a team in Palm Springs and it was the first time we were actually able to get together in person since the pandemic. It was pretty incredible, if I may say so myself. But thinking about that balance and how to maintain some of those kind of, in the easy times when people are doing great and it's just kind of celebrating things, that's not where it gets interesting. But I think of things like delivering hard feedback, building really strong, deep relationships on trust. Those are things that are more challenging, I think, in this environment and require some creative approaches.
Do you know what? Deepening those relationships, what can accelerate a relationship is often proximity. We don't have that anymore. I remember, even if you go back school age, I mean, back in the day when you're going to school, basically every single day you sit next to these people for 5-6 years or whatever. You may not even like them as personalities. You might clash, but over the period of time you've emerged and you have a very, very strong relationship with all of those people there because you know them so well. That obviously is an extreme example, but we don't have anywhere near that on remote, and we've got to think about ways to get there. What do you think about using gaming and gaming environments to build that type of relationship? Because I don't think it can be done on Zoom, I've got to be honest. But I think something where there's some sort of free world interaction in an online space might be something. Any thoughts on this, Will, just as a random speculation?
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic. I, to be honest, don't have, I think I probably don't have particularly nuanced thoughts on the subject because I haven't had too much experience. I actually have some friends whose companies have set up things like, sort of VR office spaces or, sort of having avatars and can sort of tap in and out of, sort of a virtual, I don't know if it's a game per se, but more of a virtual world. I don't know, it's interesting. I think like, I think it's healthy to be open to these types of what may sound like crazy ideas, but I don't have too strong feelings right now as I haven't tried too much of that myself.
It may be difficult to get to in terms of inclusivity, I think, because different people have different attitudes or interests in playing games generally. But I was inspired by this story. I think it was by a journalist team. They really struggled with the Zoom thing. The Zoom experience didn't help them at all. But then they latterly discovered they all played, I think it was Red Dead Redemption, like some sort of like free world game. And there's moments in the game where actually nothing happens, where you can actually have conversations with people. And they ended up doing their team meetups in Red Dead Redemption as their characters. And I thought, that's kind of cool. I totally get why that would work, because this is almost like a sense of embodiment when you see the figures interacting there that you don't get flat screen. So I'm like you. I don't know, but I'm totally open to explore these things. Now, I wonder, what other companies will be doing in this space.
I will just quickly add the other sort of direction that I know there have been some experiments. I'm not too familiar with the data on it, but is the idea of using gaming in recruiting. And when we think about inclusivity and providing different sort of channels or modes for candidates to sort of show what they're best at, I think it is a really interesting idea that, sort of given some candidates suffer more from anxiety during interviews or, sort of might be less, especially for technical roles, it may matter less kind of the sort of interaction on the call, which always ends up getting weighted pretty heavily, and might matter more approaches to problem solving, kind of, and sort of other things that might be able to surface in gaming environments. So that's another application I think in kind of RHR world that I'm interested in. I don't know what the data says, but I know there have been some folks thinking about it.
Yeah, no question. I mean, we I think with the shift to remote, we've kind of belatedly realized that the way in which we've structured not only interviewing, but even the world of work was always excluding a bunch of people, particularly, it basically always advantage extroverts, right? So if you're in an office, great, you're an extrovert, you're going to thrive. Everyone's going to say, what a nice guy he is. But if you're an introvert, you'd be who's that miserable person? do you know what I mean?
And that
obviously have a negative impact in your career. It's got nothing to do with your contribution to the job. So hopefully the shift to remote sort of opens up the doors in many respects. The countervailing problem is that it also switches it the other way. I know tons of like super extroverted friends that have struggled like heck to work in a remote only environment, like mentally had a problem with it. So I'm not sure whether we're going to get to a point where everyone's satisfied, but maybe we end up with a diversity of working modes and companies working in different ways, which is why I have no problem with companies saying, look, we're back on premise. I'm saying good, there's going to be some companies that people love that, and then some remote. We need that diversity because then we can self-select to the working modes and the companies we want to work to. Let's talk about sort of leadership lessons, Will. So you've been a manager. You've now kind of been the Uber manager, managing managers. What kind of things have you kind of learned about leading teams and leading people that you think you could kind of, if you could give yourself advice, if you could parachute back in the days, back when you're working, just when the kernel of ideas of setting up a business kind of emerged in your mind, what sort of management advice, leadership advice, should I say, would you impart on yourself that it would set that young Will in good stead?
Sure. you know, it's probably cliche, but I think the level of sort of trust and delegation in others, for me, what I would tell myself is take what you feel comfortable with and push it 50% higher. Like people, constantly amaze me. Especially again, when there are people who share values that we share and sort of are as thoughtful and sort of make it through kind of a rigorous process. I just am constantly impressed and amazed with what others are capable of. And it's not that I would doubt it really anyone. I sort of have deep belief in, you know, sort of human ability, I think. But sometimes you get in your own head that I have this context and I worked on this up until this point and it's really hard to imagine, I'll just keep this for now and sort of keep that other person's plate uncluttered or whatever it is. So again, I know it's somewhat cliche, but just the feeling of sort of giving that up, especially to other founders who I just, at least for me personally, I know how hard that can feel. And so I would say, yeah, take that comfort level and push it by 50%, maybe 100%, because you won't regret it. Obviously there'll be times where someone doesn't have all the context, but guess what? They'll ask, they'll figure it out, you know, sort of be able to work together to make it work. So in thinking back, I would probably push myself harder on that front.
Yeah, that's great advice. It's difficult to do, to let go. Obviously, as you say, it's become cliche, but I'm kind of glad it has, because it basically means that's we're mainstreaming this idea that you can kind of give, that people are much more capable of doing things than we expect them to do. And in fact, most jobs actually are a narrowing of their capability, right? We kind of mm-hmm. box people in way too much. Yeah. And, you know, if you kind of allow people to peek above the box a little bit, you might be surprised as to how much they blossom. So absolutely, you know, not only an ethical thing to do, but from a return to value, that's where you get the maximum return to value. The sort of journey that Prelude are on right now, Will, what's down the pipe for you guys? I mean, can you give us a quick snapshot state of play right now, and what can people expect in the next 6 months, and what might happen next couple of years?
Sure. Always happy and excited to talk about Prelude a little bit. So I think where we are today and kind of where we're headed, I think that we sort of get really excited about the problem space around the recruiting and specifically the candidate's experience throughout the recruiting process. And I think, like, zoomed out, we have teams, companies, managers, leaders who all struggle and all kind of, as far as I know, I haven't met one that thinks, oh, it's just easy to hire the best people I need for my team when I need them. And this was my experience as a manager and my co-founder Alex's experience as well. It's really hard. And the process, I think, to anyone that's tried to run it feels maybe at best suboptimal, and at worst, I think, very broken in some very important ways. And the insight that that I think the team has coalesced around that we're really excited about is there are a lot of tools out there that may help recruiting teams, and they're super crucial for kind of running the recruiting process. But we actually don't see as many tools. We really don't see too many tools at all that are out there helping the candidate once they enter the hiring process. When we think about sort of what that process looks like for candidates today, it has a ton of friction. It's very kind of process oriented. There's a ton of email, there's scheduling back and forth, there is, you know, prep that's being sent over, if at all, in like PDF attachments that are hard to kind of parse through. It's just this very sort of slow moving and very high friction process. And where we're oriented is in improving that by an order of magnitude. We imagine a world where candidates going through that process with companies, sort of are not confused, don't feel that it's slow or, you know, sort of old fashioned, basically like remove that friction from the process. And there are a whole set of touch points that I think are sort of really right to be sort of changed or improved. And that's kind of where we are into.
Quick interjection. For folks who are not familiar with the platform, Will, like, what do the candidates experience if they are going through a process that has Prelude support in it?
Yeah, absolutely. So our first product is called Prelude Coordinate, which focuses on workflow automation. So that's automated scheduling, confirmations, other, you know, sort of allowing recruiting teams to kind of brand that experience for candidates. And that's what, you know, sort of is used broadly by the hundreds of teams that work with Prelude today. You sort of talked about the coming few months. We're actually sort of breaking news, going to launch a new product or a new part of the platform very soon, which we call Prelude Engage. And the sort of thinking behind Engage, well, in a sentence, it's a candidate hub or portal. But the thinking behind it was that our customers, recruiting teams, said, what we love about Prelude isn't just the efficiency, it's that you're making touch points for candidates modern and easier to work with and helping us kind of stand out and build our brand. And we sort of had this idea, or honestly listened to customers, and they basically had this idea that was like, well, what other touch points can we do that to? How else can we make the experience more modern and more engaging and more immersive? And the answer was, well, besides scheduling, besides confirmations, there's still 100 other emails that go back and forth with the candidate throughout the process. And they feel really slow, and it's really hard to stand out when we know that same candidate in their inbox has 500 email threads with 5 other companies that they're talking to. And so we sort of worked with closely with some customers on saying, well, what if we take a look at all of those touch points and what would it mean to sort of unify them into something that was, yeah, more engaging and just better than what's offered today? So Prelude Engage is coming soon, and it's a single place that a company can present to a candidate to run the end-to-end process in a much more engaging way.
Right. So basically, as I imagine, this candidate enters kind of an online space somewhere, and that all that candidate needs to do is to keep going back to that space, because that's exactly where all of the stuff is, right?
Yes. Yeah. We think candidates want to know, where am I in the process? Who am I going to meet with? What do I need to know about this team? What are your values? What is the culture like? How do you think about comp? All of these hard questions that, you know, today end up either getting lost or maybe coming up here, there, or not at all. Let's be transparent. Let's put pressure on recruiting teams to do that, but that's actually not how it works. I think the best recruiting teams want to do that. They just don't have the tools or ways to kind of structurally kind of make that possible today. And that's why we're so excited about this new product.
No, recruiters are going to love this, because there's the worst conversations that a recruiter has or wants to get rid of are these update sort of calls, all these exactly coordination stuff, even, you know, all of the, and this is what forces the candidate often to chase the recruiter, and the recruiter ends up having a backlog of voicemail, a lot of email to have to deal with. Like, everyone's just making work for each other because we're trying to sequentially push information through a pipe. But if you reimagine the thing, get rid of the pipe, have a place, then suddenly things get better. So yeah, I'm excited to see this. I don't want to put pressure on the product team, but do you have a kind of an estimation in terms of timelines that people might be able to see and have a play with this?
Yeah, hey, look, Hung, I want to put pressure on the product team, so you don't have to do it. No, just kidding. We're all aligned on timelines here. Look, the timeline is the end of this quarter. So basically next month, we hope to launch and sort of announce the availability of this product. We currently have some beta users from our customer base today, amazing companies like Duolingo and Flatiron Health and many other amazing fast growing companies that have been using this and sharing it with their candidates. And we're just so excited to sort of make it available more broadly.
Yeah, fantastic. Look forward to seeing this. And I think the market's ready for this as well. It's the next obvious step that we need to get to. And this is the sort of thing that I think candidates will end up kind of evangelizing about, because I think the point you mentioned in your piece there is that the candidate is not just dealing with one process. He or she is handling multiple processes, and they're all in these email threads.
Yes.
It's a nightmare. They just need one place to go for this thing. That's all they need to, that will be a huge reduction of effort. So, and fantastic. You believe
your
that.
Point, to me, the sort of goal, us sort of winning and accomplishing our goal is candidates evangelizing this. I think candidates deserve a really great and transparent experience. And again, I think the best recruiting teams really want to give it to them. So if we can change that expectation, if you go into a process, you're looking for a new job, and you're not dreading those 10 different email threads, I think we've succeeded in sort of what we're trying to build here. There's a lot to get right to make that the case, a lot that needs to change, but we're very hopeful that we can make a positive impact there.
That's fantastic. Can you give us the 2-year forecast, like down the line? Is there what's the wider vision after, you know, 2002 is a raging success, 2003 is a similar raging success. Like where does this end for you, Will?
Yeah, I don't know where it ends. That's a fun philosophical question, but I think the sort of the next big chunk. So if we think of the goal as redefining expectations that candidates have, building just so much better of a sort of recruiting experience than what even the best teams can deliver on today. I think getting sort of communications, touch points, all the pieces of the pipe that you described, making those really great is our focus now. The next big chunk is how do we make interviews great? That's the other, in my opinion, really big piece of the process is the interviews themselves. And with our kind of workflow automation platform, Prelude Coordinate, we do support interviewers, hiring managers. We are helping even with a very early version of kind of a future product, which is supporting interviewer training and making sure that new interviewers can get ramped up and understand what it means to be an interviewer at your company. I think the next level of that is how can we help companies build amazing culture around interviewing? How can you become really great at interviewing? And that means removing bias. That means providing amazing training and support. That means celebrating our best interviewers who are taking time out of their day to actually, like, you know, help us build teams. I always think it's so funny that, you know, companies and leaders complain that everybody is so apathetic when it comes to interviewing. But you set KPIs for them that don't include interviews, and you know, sort of they of course want to just do their jobs and excel. So I think there's a huge opportunity for us to come in and really think holistically about how we can help companies not just become great at the candidate interface, but that really crucial step of all of those meetings with interviewers who are the representatives of your organization.
Yeah, and that's a great thing to do. If you could distribute the interview load across more people in your business, then guess what? You're going to have greater recruiting capacity. You know, you're going to be able to hire faster because you've got more people able to do this. And you're so right. It needs to be connected to how people are managed and measured, because you can't sort of say. I remember back in the day, people so certain good interviewers who are natively good at it, for whatever reason, they get leaned on overly much, and they end up doing they get 3 times more interviews than everyone else, and you wonder why their performance and then day to day job is decreasing.
Exactly,
full time interviewing, you know,
or they just leave, right? Like, it's hard to retain those people because you're at, you know, especially those, you know, the folks who are so nice, they never want to say no, but you're asking them to do 6 interviews a week, and it's like, you know, I can't do my regular day job. So you're 100% right. Can we be more structured in how we distribute interviews? Can we raise the quality of interviews? Can we celebrate great performance in interviews? Can we even measure who makes great decisions over time and how we can sort of use that to become better as an interviewing organization? These are all, I think, really interesting problems that filter in, again, to sort of like a broad hiring platform that Prelude is building to consistently deliver an amazing experience to candidates. So that's a little bit maybe on a 1 to 2 year time horizon of what comes next.
That's great stuff. Well, let's end the conversation where we started it with your move from your recent move back to New York from San Francisco. Certainly a personal reason to move. So I don't want to necessarily dive into that, but what was the business impact of this? Was there any, and how would that factor into your thinking and before you made this decision?
Yeah, I'll be honest, very little. In that we've had a number of folks who have now moved cross country or to very different places on the team, and they've set a real great example that, you know, there's a little bit of rescheduling, one-on-ones and things like that based on time zones, but other than that, we already had such a distributed team that luckily I didn't have to worry too much or think too hard about impact on kind of the team or the business. My co-founder moved about a year ago from the West Coast to North Carolina, so that went off relatively without a hitch. One of the benefits of being committed to distributed work.
Well, imagine if you decided to set up shop in San Francisco, that would suddenly be, if the CEO decides to move to New York, that's actually something that would go to board level, wouldn't it? It would not be a small decision to make. So almost the shift to remote gives you much more optionality. Like suddenly all of those choices become less impactful, which is good because you can make those choices more casually, which is fantastic to see.
Yep.
Okay, well, listen, we're coming to the end of the day. So end of the show, should we say. So let me let you go. What busy CEOing things do you need to get on with after this call, Will?
I am back to back with a customer call, a new company that we're onboarding I can't share their name, but a really amazing, huge company that many of us know and love. And yeah, I'll be joining that just to kind of learn and listen as I try to do from that process and experience.
Do you ever put buffers in your meetings, or are you like literally on? Because I can see the clock right now; it's ticked over. So you might.
Yep. We have another teammate on the call. I gave her a heads up that I might be a minute or two late, but. You know, I need to get better at buffers, especially from software that helps with scheduling. You would think I would figure that out.
Let me tell you this: traditional calendar apps literally don't understand buffers. They need to understand buffers.
Believe it or not, we do have buffers built into Prelude, but I don't use them. I book myself back to back, and but Hung, it's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on. It was really nice to chat.
Will, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much, and good luck with the call. I hope you close it, man.
Thanks. Have a good one. Bye.
Wow, what a great guy. Really enjoyed speaking with Will Laufer. Will Laufer of CEO of Prelude, prelude.co. If you want to improve your recruitment efficiency, and you can just hear from the conversation we had, lots of new things happening with that platform, go check it out. I think there's no reason why we couldn't reimagine a lot of the things we think are sacrosanct in our recruitment process. So prelude.co. Okay, folks, that's about it for the show. Thanks for watching. We'll be back on Thursday because I'm traveling. I'm going to be in Berlin tomorrow, and in fact on Thursday I'll be doing Brain Food Live instead of Friday. We're going to be talking about moving to salary transparency. So if you're a business that is looking at this and wondering, oh, how exactly do we do this and how should we do this, sign up to the show, because we've got a bunch of folks that have made that transition. They're going to share learnings with us, how to move your company to a salary transparent posture. We're going to be there Thursday, 12 p.m. BST. Okay, that's about it, everyone. Thanks for watching.